You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Bannick.
Today, we're meeting at a moment when the language and politics of development feel unusually fluid. In some capitals, aid budgets are shrinking and slogans are getting louder. In others, such as Delhi, Nairobi, and Abuja, you hear a quieter confidence. Countries are setting their own pace, their own priorities, and finding new partners to get there. If you look only inside the capitals of the global north, it can feel like the story is retreat and doubt. But if you widen the lens, you see experimentation, regional leadership, and a growing insistence that policy should be judged by what it delivers. Jobs, learning, health, dignity. That tension between global institutions and national agency, between the politics of donors and the priorities of citizens, is the focus of our conversation today. My guest brings a rare combination of clarity and practicality to all of this. Rachel Glenister is the president of the Center for Global Development based in Washington, D.C., a nonpartisan organization that works to reduce global poverty and improve lives through innovative economic research that drives better policy and practice by the world's top decision makers. Rachel has spent her career moving between academia and government, turning evidence into choices that ministers, finance officials, and frontline practitioners can actually make. She's frank about trade-offs, allergic to performative complexity, and relentless about staying focused on what works. In our conversation, we keep the politics in view because development is always about power and incentives, but we also stay grounded in delivery. What should donors protect when budgets fall? How can multilaterals be used, not just admired? When is borrowing for health the least bad option? And how do we communicate results in a way that invites the public back into the conversation rather than pushing them away? I hope you enjoy this conversation. And by the way, I always enjoy hearing from listeners. Your reflections, suggestions, and critiques help shape future episodes. And if you like the show, please help spread the word by recommending In Pursuit of Development within your networks. Please also consider rating the show or leaving a short review wherever you listen. Rachel, lovely to see you in person. You were on the show 2 years ago, but that was over Zoom. This is much more fun.
It was so much more fun to see you in person.
Welcome to Oslo. We've even got the sun out for you.
It's beautiful.
I want to get us started with how you see development. What is going on inside the Beltway? Please tell me. Give us some fresh nuggets of information. How is development being spoken of in DC?
I mean, I should say how am I seeing development is not, DC is only one really small part of that. You know, we shouldn't get too distracted by what is happening in the US political system. I mean, I know it's very intense when you're there, but I've just come back from India. And, you know, India is obviously facing huge tariffs from the US. But in terms of development and the end of US aid, they're the main people in charge of development in India. I mean, they are driving development there. And outside actors are less, you know, far less important, I think, than sometimes you think when you're within the Beltway. But there's no doubt that it's been quite a traumatic time for those of us who care about development and aid and evidence over the last few months. Because you see, you know, there's been this populist criticism of experts. You know, I'm surrounded by people who've lost their jobs in development, who've spent a lifetime working for development. And that's really hard. Another big part, though, of development inside the Beltway is the IMF and World Bank. And there, I think things are a little bit more optimistic than I thought might be the case a few months ago.
Well, that's good to know, because I was going to ask you, how are the bank people and the IMF people actually seeing this? Are they more shielded from the daily US drama?
Well, I think they are doing better in relationship to the Trump administration than some people feared. You know, there was a very anxious couple of months there as the Trump administration reviewed their policies towards the IMF and World Bank. And, you know, there were a lot of proposals before the election suggesting that the Republicans should be withdrawing from the IMF and World Bank. That was a tense few months. But I think now we're in a reasonable place where, at least in the budget that Trump put forward, there was, you know, a substantial amount of money going to the concessional arm of the World Bank, so IDA, and not pulling out of the IMF or World Bank. And I think that reflects the fact that the administration realized that they get quite a good deal out of those organizations. They have quite a big influence in them, and those organizations have quite a big influence in the world. And so it would be really to shoot themselves in the foot to pull out.
I was reading a blog by our friend Charles Kenny.
Yes.
And he was outlining the fact that one doesn't really know what's going on. USAID is dismantled, but there's still some flows, but one isn't sure where it is going, how it's going to be determined. Congress is not really very active. So there's a lot of doubt and uncertainty. But going back to this, what you said about the World Bank and IMF, what was a bit shocking, at least for me, in March, was when the Trump administration pulled out of the 2030 agenda and the SDGs. So it seems that they've targeted the UN.
Yes.
And just this morning, I was actually reading a piece by Adam Tooze in Foreign Policy, because as we sit here on the 9th of September, the UN General Assembly is starting.
Yep.
And he's been arguing in this piece that this is the end of development, you know, the end of the Western idea of development, that apparently the Trump administration looked at the 2030 agenda and some of those formulations about, you know, peaceful coexistence and peace among civilizations to mean that this is just taken out of Xi Jinping's playbook, that this is, you know, embracing the Chinese Communist Party's ideology or whatever. But his argument is that somehow, you know, one needs something new. And this, you know, makes me think about what you said earlier about you having been to India. When I've been to India and China and South Africa of late, I don't see this kind of disillusionment, or what I do notice is dissatisfaction with the world order, that they aren't getting enough out of it. They don't have the influence as Washington or Europe has. They want greater say, but I notice much more optimism. So in my work, I've been arguing that, look, this is not the end of the world. This is not collapse. No. This is the start of something new. There's so many opportunities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is absolutely not the end of development. It has always been the case that most development happens as a result of policies in low and middle income countries, as a result of the work in the, you know, the individuals in those countries. And, you know, the influence of the rich world is important and relevant. And at the Center for Global Development, we focus on trying to make those policies better. Not just aid, but trade and migration. And trade is hugely important driver of growth, just like innovation is a hugely important driver of growth. That's not ending because Trump pulled out of the SDGs. That's elevating the role of the US to much higher than it should be. Now, do I think that things could be done better? Absolutely. But it's not the end of development.
But the US was a big player, is a big player, puts in a lot of money in the UN, but also in aid. So I suppose the concern is that nobody, as far as I know, has really stepped up to the same extent. So somebody has to fill the gap. And again, going back to Adam Tooze's article, he mentions Norway or Qatar, you know, it's like, or the EU, you know, somebody has to step up. So I agree with you that it's not the US that should determine everything, but they've always put in a lot of money.
They put in a lot of money. I think the way to see this is there are certain countries who are going to be very badly hit, certain sectors and certain sectors in certain countries. That's why I'm saying it's not development as a whole, but it's particular countries and particular sectors. And I was just looking at the data recently. There are countries who are losing 6-7% of GNI in aid per year. That's a huge hit.
And one of those is my favorite, Malawi,
yes,
which is hugely aid dependent. And the US has played a very important role. Mind you, we've also been in lots of discussions. I've been engaging with my Malawian colleagues saying, Because there was at one point in March, April, May, this sense of doom and gloom. What right. are we going to do, at least right. in a country like Malawi? And I was saying, well, come on, maybe it's time to wake up. You know, we have to yep. explore other avenues. So maybe there's a positive spin on all of this. We can always put a positive spin. But I'm worried about, you know, the US not supporting the SDGs, because then the others would be not as enthusiastic, perhaps. You know, when the biggest player in the room leaves, there is this sense of, you know, why should we, the others, care? But the flip side of things is maybe the Global South is going to step up, and they have already. South-South cooperation is booming. That's also something I've been arguing in my work, that the optimism stems from South-South, maybe even increased ties between the European Union and China and India, etc. Maybe the US will realize that, you know, this enormous amount of soft power that it had through these generous donations in aid, which, by the way, was actually saving lives. It wasn't just giving away yeah. money, that they're going to miss that kind of soft power.
Yeah. So there will be a lot of lives lost as a result of the shutdown of USAID. And that is an absolute tragedy. And there will be countries that will step up and will be able to step up. I mean, the US had very much focused, for example, on HIV treatment. And there were a lot of countries that were, you know, letting the US really run its HIV treatment. And countries like South Africa and to some extent Kenya will be able to come in and do that. And it's absolutely not the way to run things to have it shut down overnight. And a lot of people will die as a result. But there are countries where it will be possible for, you know, the government, the local government, to step up and be able to fill. And there are other countries that there just isn't that capacity, and people will be really badly hit. And no,
I'm thinking of PEPFAR.
Yeah,
thinking
exactly.
of Paul Farmer, you know, my friend. I mean, instrumental in setting up PEPFAR and many, many other initiatives.
Yeah. And severe acute malnutrition, the US has spent a lot of money on that. And a lot of that goes to refugees and internally displaced people who are not always the priority for the local government. So there are a lot of people who are down on the list of not, you know, of low priority for other actors that the US was supporting, and those people will be badly hit. Which is, I think, very different from saying development won't continue yeah. because, you know, China will continue to grow, India will continue to grow, a lot of people's lives will improve, but the most vulnerable in the most vulnerable countries will suffer a lot. Who's going to step up? It's not clear that anyone will. You know, again, South Africa will probably step up to do more HIV interventions. You know, maybe Kenya will take on more, although they're in a very difficult fiscal position. But other places, they won't be able to. I don't see that UAE is going to come in and fill this gap. I don't see, you know, Gates Foundation coming in filling all these gaps. The most optimistic is that more of it will happen through multilateral development banks. So there were parts of the health architecture that the US was really supporting. And I think countries are going to have to borrow through the MDBs to pay for some of that work. And there was a lot of reluctance in the health community to have countries borrow to do that. But, you know, to some extent, that will end up filling the gap.
One positive side of that, or if you were to interpret it in a positive light, is that this would perhaps make some of these leaders, national leaders, that were often, you know, relying on aid to support, to fund the health sector, education, these were not things that they were so interested in using taxpayer money to fund. They were using this money for maybe vanity projects or other things, that this would wake them up to say that, oh, we have to now prioritize health. The donors are not there anymore. We have to make sure that medicines come in. We have to fund hospitals, you know. And so maybe there would be a reawakening, much more concern about these sectors being funded with national taxpayer money than just from donors.
Interestingly, I think a lot of education was already being funded. I think health is one of the ones that will be badly hit. And as they say, you know, refugees and internally displaced people. So the other area where, if you are looking for an upside, is that I think it will force donors, I hope it will force donors to be much better at prioritizing. So you were talking about governments doing better prioritization, and I hope that happens. But there's also a real need for some of these agencies that are seeing big cuts. So some of the UN agencies, some of the multilateral agencies who are seeing very big cuts. I really hope that we take this crisis as an opportunity to push through some reforms that people have thought of, you know, I've thought are needed for a very long time. I've just come from a meeting at the OECD DAC Committee of Donors and was pushing them to think about strategic cuts. Like, if you're going to have to cut, how are you going to do it in a way that preserves the most good of what is being done by some of these organizations and use it as a time to consolidate, to, you know, reduce some of the less cost-effective things that were being done.
I'm glad you mentioned that it's not just the national leaders, it's also the donors that have to do things differently because they're trying to justify use of aid money to their taxpayers. Perhaps the problem is, Rachel, that we haven't really been paying much attention to the politics of development, because since 2015, there's been this positive narrative, you know, Addis Ababa Declaration on Financing for Development, the Paris Agreement, the SDGs, the 2030 Agenda. We felt everything was moving in the right direction, that development was apolitical. But development is always about power. It is always about influence. And perhaps we've underestimated the kind of influence that donors were exerting or wanted to exert. Everybody wants something. It's just that the donors don't really articulate this interest very well, whereas China does very explicitly. I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. But sometimes in the global north, the message has been more about, oh, I care for you, you poor people, you know, I'm going to save you. Maybe we need to reframe that narrative. That's one. And number two is to talk more about effectiveness, what works, put evidence at the heart and center of aid policy. But my impression was that there was quite a lot of talk about evidence before the Trump administration came to office. Samantha Powers was talking about it. Dean Carlin, who I'm going to have on the show next week, has been talking about it. So there's a lot of talk about evidence, and yet I suppose we need more of it. Going forward, do you think that aid agencies have to have a new conversation about aid effectiveness, priorities within the organization, but also what is happening on the ground? Is that what the agenda should be?
So I think there needs to be a new narrative. Absolutely. And we have lost the general public. There was much more support in the general public for aid, you know, in the 1990s and the early 2000s. It wasn't very deep. You scratch the surface. It wasn't, you know, very strong. But it has really changed. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I think something that didn't help, I'm not saying it caused the change, but something that didn't help was that as development experts, we pushed people away. We pushed regular people away. We said it's all so far too complicated. You don't understand it. Trust us, we understand it. You know, keep out of it. And we went for these very complex narratives and very complicated view of development, and development is complicated, but in a way that shut people out. And I think about how, for example, the UK used to have very clear results-based, you know, targets. We will get this many children in school. We will save this many lives. And development experts hated that because A, they felt constrained by it, and B, they felt it was reducing a complicated system to kind of a few numbers. But what struck me when I talked to the incoming politicians who were taking on the development portfolio, and I went through a lot because there was a lot of turnover in the UK while I was working in government, was they really wanted that. They were like, help me make the case for aid in Parliament and with my constituency. And I need some basic numbers that I can talk very simply about what's going on. And there was a bit of a sense of, oh, that's so naive. You don't understand how complex it is. And we stopped giving them the numbers, the kind of simple numbers and the simple narrative. Because we said, no, Minister, it's, you know, far more complicated than that.
But do you think part of this problem is because of the Daily Mail effect? cash transfers, even if there's evidence that it is working, the Daily Mail would publish a front page saying, oh, people are just getting free cash and not doing anything. I mean, do you think experts reacted to that? I mean, they wanted to nuance the picture?
Look, I think the Daily Mail attacks on aid were absolutely important, and there's some academic evidence about populist messages reducing the support for aid. So I think that's clear. I don't think that's why development professionals didn't want to go with these more simplistic messages.
Why don't you think? Are we just not comfortable talking a simple
language? Yeah, because, yes, because poverty is multidimensional. You can't reduce it to simple numbers. It's about power, all of which I agree with, but not to the extent that I want to push people away. And, you know, there was a lot of hostility to people visiting low-income countries and, you know, poverty porn. And I mean, yes, there are things in that that make my, you know, skin crawl. But we can't afford to be pushing away people who actually care and haven't spent their lives understanding, you know, some of the complex nuances. So there's a lot going on we don't have control over. But as development professionals, there are things that we do have control over. And I think being unwelcoming to non-professionals is not helping. But at least we can fix that. Now, that's different from the evidence side, but I actually think the evidence side, we have to use the evidence to make some simple stories, because most people won't get into the level of evidence that, you know, you and I like to dig into. So I was just talking to, you know, colleagues at NORAD this afternoon about how you can use the evidence to kind of model what the impact is and then use that to, you know, make some simple numbers about the case of the impact that you're having. Now, to do that, you also need to be a lot more simple in what you're trying to do. So one of the things I've been pushing for is a radical simplification in aid. And I think that's important partly to improve effectiveness. So we concentrate on a few things as donors and recognize we can't possibly do everything. Very inefficient to try and do a little bit of everything. It's much better to specialize. But it also helps us make a case, you know, to our populations about what we're doing, because we can make a simple story about what it is that we as Norway, we as the UK are doing. What's our expertise? How are we helping? How many people are we helping? Whereas if you're trying to do, you know, thousands of different projects, each with 12 different components, like, it's just really hard to make the case.
I suppose, you know, the trouble is that development has indeed become very complex, because yep. We keep talking about this holistic picture. You can't just specialize. You have to become a jack of all trades. And that means that we say that everything is connected with everything. But, you know, one of the many feedback I get on the podcast is that we often discuss these problems in a rather simplified way. Unlike the books and articles we write that very few people read, the podcast is listened to widely because it's a conversation. Another example I have is in terms of, you know, increasingly with age, I feel like we really need to, as academics, I'm not a practitioner, but I can't expect the politicians and the bureaucrats to actually read my articles. Maybe they have time for the abstract, but the podcast is one key vehicle. The other is actually when a new Minister of International Development is appointed, I get to have a word with him or her.
Yeah.
A new ambassador to Malawi or wherever from Norway is appointed, I get to have a consultation, maybe send them my open access book. And to have that parallel channel open where we try to simplify, not that they can't understand complex stuff, but they need quick information.
Yeah.
And I think those are things that we academics should be doing much more of. But it has to be said, Rachel, not everybody's comfortable doing that. People just feel that, okay, you know, I've written something, my job is done. It's up to somebody else to digest that information.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I believe in comparative advantage. So I believe that not everybody is very good at doing that. I mean, I'm on a panel of experts that includes practitioners and includes academics. who try and synthesize the evidence in education and boil it down to what do you actually do as a result of this, and provide some practical recommendations that could be read by a minister. And so there's a role for that, I think, for people who are interpreters. And I've always thought of that as my career, actually. I'm an interpreter. I've gone backwards and forwards from academia to policy and, you know, backwards and forwards multiple times. And in both, my role has always been to understand the other side and try and explain one to the other.
The story so far, you're saying, is that we need to simplify radically the message in
and what we do. Not
and
just
what
the
we
message.
Do. In Norway, we've just finished a long election campaign period.
Yes.
And there's been some frustration that international development did not get much attention. In fact, very little attention. It's almost like that is not a part of what politicians felt that the voters cared about.
Yeah.
What I think the aid community here today is heaving a sigh of huge relief is that the Progress Party that had been saying, we don't like the 1% target, you know, GNI of aid, we're going to go back to 0.7. That is probably not going to happen. So I think a lot of practitioners, NGOs are really, really happy today. I mean, one thing is communicating to the ministers and the aid agencies. The other thing is the public. And here, I think NORAD actually gives some money to NGOs to do that kind of information outreach work. Maybe we should be thinking about, you know, scaling up that kind of stuff. And in my case, I've been often a bit frustrated, Rachel. I felt that some of the NGOs, and I'm not targeting anybody, I felt that they were often worried about the Daily Mail effect in each country, because there was always this fear that if you said something did not work optimally, or there's been some theft or some, you know, misappropriation or something happened, there were huge risks with some of these projects, that the media would really criticize them, and the opposition parties that don't like aid would say, oh, cut funding.
Yeah.
So there was this silence on stuff that one should be talking more about. So my take on this is that we should be communicating. I certainly agree with you, but we should be talking about the successes and the failures. And that narrative then would be more credible than just talking about apparent successes.
Yeah, it's hard. You know, I've been in government with that pressure of where everyone's worried about, people talk about the Daily Mail test, right? The problem is, you know, some elements of the press will jump on things irrespective of whether they're actually a failure or not. I mean, there was this example of Ethiopian Spice Girls, which is, you know, still...
You know, I haven't heard that. Since,
well, it was picked up by the press in the UK as a project that was clearly ridiculous, because it was, you know, we were funding some, you know, a pop group in Ethiopia to get their word out. Well, actually what it was a media campaign for girls to reproductive health. And media is actually an extremely cost-effective way. There was absolutely nothing wrong with this program, but it could be twisted in a way that could make it sound silly. So it's not just that we don't talk about our failures. You know, people were very reluctant to do media programs after that, even though media is an extremely cost-effective way to get the message out about development. One thing I would say, though, is actually the evidence suggests that the more information people have about aid, not necessarily positive, they just don't know very much about development.
So there's a hunger for more information.
Well, I don't know whether there's a hunger, there's a lack of knowledge. Mm. And if you get people by some means to learn more about it, positive or negative, they actually end up supporting, on average, they end up supporting it more. The problem is that it's really hard to get to people now because they're not listening to the main news programs. You know, people who listen to the main news programs actually support aid. It's the people who don't listen to the main news programs that you're not that aren't. And so how do you get them? Because you can't work through the normal channels. It's mainly social media. So yes, I think clever social media strategy is part of this, but it's really hard to get attention in this environment.
Indeed. And everybody is competing for, you know, now it's Ukraine, yep. It's Gaza, it is Sudan, yes. Or maybe,
you know,
we should be talking more about
it. Climate change, yeah. And Gaza, and you know, idealistic young people are not focusing on development in the way that they were when I was growing up. So.
Well, so this is another critique, Rachel, that I hear increasingly outside Europe, outside the United States, is that for you guys, development is a fifth floor issue. You're talking about higher level needs in richer countries. We are still stuck on the first floor.
Yep.
We are still interested in poverty reduction. Mm-hmm. But you guys are talking about climate, which you have, you know, polluted, and now you're not paying for it. And you're preaching to us to keep our natural gas under the ground, not to exploit fossil fuel resources. So there's a lot of frustration with the double standards. Because,
absolutely.
So development, this is my sort of take on it, means different things in our parts of the world to what, you know, it means in Malawi, India, China, or Latin America.
So first of all, I think we absolutely should not be lecturing anyone at low-income countries on their use of fossil fuels. So policies like the no development aid should be spent on, you know, fossil fuels, I think is just insane and inappropriate policy. The problem is it's a very easy policy to
And that's
announce.
Meant to placate the
yes.
taxpayers here or the voters.
Yes. But it's such a tiny amount of carbon that it's not relevant. Now, what is relevant is the middle-income countries. So the Indias, Pakistans, China, obviously, but China is doing a lot of work on climate change. Those are the countries that are really growing and are actually soon to be a very substantial proportion, not just of annual emissions, but the stock of emissions. People think that the rich world is responsible for kind of 80, 90% of the stock of emissions over all time. It's nothing like that anymore. So it is really important, if we are going to make the planet a livable planet, that there is progress in middle-income countries. You know, forget the Malawis, the Sierra Leones, like what they do just is not contributing, and we should not be putting tough conditions on them. How do you have a conversation with an India? It's really hard because, yeah, we did terrible policies and it sounds really double standards to, you know, lecture them. Lecturing is not going to work, but innovation that helps make it easier for them to do carbon reduction, that helps their own needs, like very bad air pollution. If they stop producing, you know, if they stop burning coal, they would save a lot of lives in India and Pakistan. We need a very different narrative about how to work on climate change in these countries.
This reminds me of a conversation I had with the chief financial editor of the Financial Times. And he was saying, this is at a seminar a couple of years ago, he was saying that what we do is immaterial. It's India and China alone. Yep. If they're not a part of the solution,
yep.
We can forget it. But what India and China are still clinging on to is that historical emission level. So I suppose that kind of criticism from the West towards India and China, et cetera, is also valid that, yeah, historically we polluted, but you guys are also polluting now, especially China. But I want to return to the UK, Rachel, since you served in government. I was reading that the government now trying to figure out what is it it's going to cut, because it's cutting billions.
Yep.
And apparently the only sectors that it has somehow signaled that it'll continue supporting is some sort of humanitarian effort. It's Gaza, Ukraine. I don't know if it's Gaza, but at least Ukraine and maybe Sudan. I think these are the three sort of hot spots that the UK is going to prioritize. Well, what are your thoughts there? Because we talk a lot about US aid being dismantled. What's going on in the UK? What are the debates there?
Yes, it's a series of big cuts now, you know, on top of big cuts over the last couple of years. And it's very substantial. They are having some really deep self-questioning about where are we most effective? Where should we put our scarce resources? I hope that they will. I haven't finally decided exactly where the cuts will fall, but I hope they will simplify and prioritize, you know, cut back on the number of countries, because if you've got, you know, substantially less money, you shouldn't be you know, salami slicing, you should prioritize. They will be prioritizing multilaterals because of the leverage that you get there. So, you know, $1 into IDA, you countries get $3 out, whereas we don't do loans in the UK. So you do, if you do it through the World Bank, it get highly concessional loans, but it is loans, so you get that multiplication. Then the question is, where in the bilateral side should they focus? My understanding is they're focusing on four sectors. That doesn't mean that they won't do things in other sectors, but they will prioritize four sectors. All know, but humanitarian is one and health is one. I commend that. I think other agencies that are having to cut should prioritize. And I think the multilaterals that are facing cuts because, for example, the US is pulling out, really need to go through that prioritization.
I'm thinking about the UN agencies.
Absolutely. And I do not see that happening at the moment. So one of my campaigns and one of the things that the Center for Global Development is doing a lot of work on is how should we make those tough cuts? So we have a series called Tough Times, Tough Choices. Okay, we wish we weren't in this situation, but given that we are, and the WHO is facing 60% cut in its budget, what should it protect and what should it cut? It goes through the evidence, it goes through sort of the rationale for Gavi and the we'll soon come out with a global fund, but WHO is already done. And what you need then is for donors or the, you know, the different participants in these organizations to get together and be willing and agree to make some tough prioritization.
There's, I think, a growing realization that aid is just a tiny, yes, tiny bit here, right, on the global, yep, development story. And I felt that sometimes in our parts of the world, Rachel, we've exaggerated the role of aid. Mm-hmm. And this is particularly to appease those who don't like aid, to so show some sort of evidence that, you know, because of us, so many people, yes, have been saved. Whereas the real success stories are often national development, China, yep, and India, etc. So aid has an important role, and I agree with you. It is to these countries that are not these big economies in the global south, smaller countries facing all kinds of challenges, whether, as Paul Collier talks about, the different types of traps, you know, whether you're landlocked or whatever.
Yeah.
But there's also the need at these aid agency level, the organization, to generate evidence. And it's about time that those that weren't doing a good job of knowing, and this is something I've often asked a lot of aid agency officials, tell me about something that really is a success, and they're scrambling around. They're not truly sure. I would like to be much more confident in my answer, saying, look, we've been funding this, and this really is an unqualified success.
Yep.
So I suppose some agencies have had that tradition of evaluation, knowing what is effective, and some are not. But if there's one agency that I remember being very good at this, was DFID.
Yep.
And so I would imagine that in the UK, the evidence is pretty much solid, or is that not the case?
I think what DFID was good at, and FCDO still is somewhat good at, is two things. One is knowing the evidence. So it's not about whether you evaluate your own programs, mainly. It's about knowing what the evidence is and then prioritizing spending money on the things for which that are cost effective, that there's evidence that they're cost effective.
So it's translating the evidence into action.
Yes. And that was something that DFID was very good at, and the FCDO is still pretty good at, although it's lost some good people in the merger and the cuts. The second thing that DFID was good at, and again, FCDO is still good at, but it will face cuts, is generating the evidence. Because that is a global public good. And it is something that bilateral agencies are very good at. So you're right, the aid is a tiny fraction of total spending on development. Most of that is spent by developing country governments and the poor themselves, right? They're the ones who spend the most on,
indeed,
on education and health in low and middle income countries and poverty reduction. They're the ones who are making it happen. So what can aid do? Like, what is it good at? One of the things it's good at is funding the evidence that then helps low and middle income countries prioritize how they spend their money. So an example of this would be the funding that AusAid, the Australian aid agency, yeah, spent funding work with the Indonesian government about how to improve Indonesia's poverty programming. So Indonesia spends billions every year on
social protection,
right? Giving money to poor people in Indonesia. Taxpayers, money from Indonesia going to other Indonesians. But that could be improved. The effectiveness of that could be improved. So what AusAid did is they funded researchers to work with the Indonesian government to figure out how to make those programs more effective. And one of them led to a 26% increase in the amount of money that was actually getting to recipients through this aid program, right? It was a subsidized rice program, and it provided people with information about how much rice they were given. So very, very cheap program, very cheap investment relatively by the Australian aid agency, and, you know, huge returns. Similar thing happened in India with donor money funding some work with the Indian government about how to improve their biggest.
I know there were some success stories, the Gates Foundation, actually, in terms of polio, HIV. It's this private-public partnership, putting in little resources. So what you're saying is not just budget support, as many donors are doing, right? Propping up the national budget with good intentions, you know, saying that we want the government to take credit or plan according to its needs rather than us being on the ground, fragmented picture, too many donors doing too many different things. Let's just get the government to do it. But what you're saying is not just budget support, but technical support, helping bureaucracy, strengthening capacity.
Yeah, so there's technical support. There's also just generating the evidence, which then the governments use themselves. For example, a lot of governments are now putting and getting money from the World Bank to do structured pedagogy, which is a particular way of teaching that dramatically improves how much children learn. Well, why do we know that's effective? Because DFID funded some programs, some RCTs in Kenya that tested it out and found that it did work. And so now it's not just Kenya. It's not just that they work with the Kenyan government. It's, you know, Cote d'Ivoire is just scaling this up across the whole country based on funding from the World Bank. So it's not that DFID was funding Cote d'Ivoire. No, they funded the original RCT that then, but it's not just RCTs. It's, you know, malaria vaccine. It's new climate resilient maize. So when I talk about R&D, I mean that whole range of things, from how do you get more out of your social protection program to having a vaccine for malaria.
And I'm thinking about something that some of my colleagues have been arguing, you know, funding national statistics offices. Mm-hmm. There's no money. It's not very attractive. And so this actually goes to something that is also, I suppose, a problem. We tend to prioritize things that resonate well at home. Mm-hmm. We want to talk about our values. We want to promote our values, whether it is women's rights, climate, you know, something that resonates with our taxpayers. But funding the National Statistics Office is not something that's going to get you much credit. But talking about R&D and innovation, one of the things that I'm bombarded with every day, and I was speaking to Pedro Concesio, the director of the Human Development Report at UNDP just a few days ago. We were talking about the latest UNDP report, you know, the HDR. It's on AI.
Yep.
And I was really trying to narrow down on how AI is promoting human development. And he had some examples of apps, etc. If I were to put it to you, Rachel, that, you know, I mean, one side of the story is that maybe we are too optimistic about AI, how it's going to help us. But based on everything that you're saying now, in terms of generating the evidence, in terms of looking at thousands and thousands of documents and figuring out who to target, which areas are the most needy, doing RCTs, it seems to me that AI can be, you know, fantastic at this, the big data, giving policymakers something tangible that maybe humans are incapable of.
Yes, I think there's a lot of potential there. I mean, there are obviously also concerns that people have about whether, you know, some countries will be left behind. But I think that means that we should be putting a lot of focus on what would AI for development look like? What are the areas that are most promising? Let's talk about some specifics of where I think it could really help. It's leading to much better weather forecasting. And we know from previous evidence that if you provide farmers with better weather forecasts, they will adapt and they will plant different crops and they will know when to plant and when to put the fertilizer and when it won't be washed away. So they will increase their yield substantially if they get better weather forecasts. And so AI is really helping with that. I think there's a lot more to do there. And that's happening. So there is work on AI for education. And there, what's interesting is people are looking at, can you use AI to more cheaply or better deliver things that we know are effective, but AI might be able to reduce the costs. So whether it's, you know, more adaptive learning programming or sending children like text messages with questions, which has been proved to be quite effective, helping parents support children mm-hmm. in their education. Then there's, on the health side, it might be very different. It might be, you know, AlphaFold. It might be about how do you, you know, we might get a whole bunch of new medicines. It might be cheaper to repurpose existing medicines for new diseases or, you know, diseases that they weren't currently licensed for through AI. So I think those are very, very different uses of AI. You know, some are, you know, literally about the interface between parents and their children, very kind of on the ground. And one is developing new medicines that are relevant for low and middle income countries.
For me, one common theme in all of these examples is accessing information. Of course, firstly, mm-hmm. we need to have electricity, need to have power. And there's some good news there. Just today, I was reading a report that the African continent apparently is importing much more solar panels from China mm-hmm. than it was doing. So it's really scaling up. So let's say you have electricity, you know, you have a mini grid in a village. The farmers can access that weather report that was being perhaps produced, but they were not reaching the users. The same thing with schools, not having textbooks. You know, something like open access books, massive open online courses. You know, think about some of the top journals that are paid for. A lot of libraries in the Global South don't have access to that. So I'm thinking that, you know, that kind of overarching theme that AI could really support is to make information free, if that helps. Of course, the other part of the story is, how is that information going to be used?
Yeah, I have a slightly different view.
Okay.
Both on information and on energy, but let's start with energy. So some of the examples I gave you do not require electricity, actually. So to develop a new drug, you need electricity where you're developing it, but you don't need it poor people to have access to electricity. I'm not saying it's bad for poor people to have access to electricity. I'm just saying that's not, you don't need it for the AI. The AI is happening somewhere else. The weather forecasting is just texting on people's phones.
Right, but you still need to charge the phone, right?
You need to charge the phone, but that's very little. I mean, a lot of people have the ability to do that. That doesn't require a grid. It doesn't really require a mini grid. I mean, yes, maybe some. I'm very excited about the solar panel price reduction. I actually think the main place that we need investment in energy is for firms in Africa, not individuals. Why? Because unfortunately, if people are poor enough, providing them electricity doesn't help much because they can't afford the machines to go with it, by which I mean, you know, yes, they might be able to afford a light, but they don't. But a lot of the equipment,
so manufacturing capacity needs to be scaled. Is that,
well, no, the individuals can't afford an iron or a fridge or, you know, the things that would be useful to have electricity for. But what would be useful is if the firms in these countries had reliable electricity and didn't have to spend a huge amount on generators, and then they would find it cheaper. You would get more foreign investment. And then they would hire the people who would then be able to afford to buy an iron and a fridge and stuff. I think the evidence supports that we really need reliable electricity for firms in Africa rather than getting microgrids to, you know, rural villages.
We can do both things at the same time.
Talked about prioritizing.
Well, it doesn't have to be just donor driven.
This is not about donors.
Right.
Governments have to prioritize,
too. But the thing is, some of these country governments, they're very good at saying to outside investors, come and invest in our country. We'll give you free land, water, etc. But there's no power. So in that sense, I understand that you have to.
That's the priority for me.
Yeah.
Is getting power, and not just for foreign investors, come in for local firms to be able to expand. It's a major constraint. And again, there's good evidence that, you know, the places in Brazil that were appropriate for hydro grew much faster, which suggests that in Brazil's development, it was really important to have access to reliable energy. So that's the energy. The information, using the information, being able to turn it into useful information that people can use is really important. You know, we're talking about a text message to a parent, not which takes, you know, so it's thinking about what's the right text message to send to a parent to ask the kid, you know, not was how was school, but like an actual question that you can then talk about. And, you know, that's shown to be very important in children's learning. That's very different from giving that parent, you know, access to massive online courses.
But
it's the relevant piece of information going to the relevant person. It's like figuring out what information on the weather. They don't need a smartphone with apps, with maps of where, you know, so that they can become an expert in weather. No, you tell them the monsoon is coming to your neighborhood next week.
But, you know, I had a student writing a thesis about the Kenyan health system. This is many years ago. And she found that they were using text messages to schedule appointments.
Yes,
so this is
absolutely.
Not AI. This is something that has been, you know, happening for a long time in some of these countries like Kenya, which has been the front runner.
Yes. The text messaging has been along and it's been very useful for appointments. I mean, again, lots of evidence that, you know, sending text messages for appointments is very helpful. But where the AI came in is it was used to figure out that the monsoon's coming next week. And the Indian government does predict the monsoon, but not very well, and it can do it better with AI. And it predicts when the monsoon arrives in the south of the country, and it's not very good at saying it arrives in, you know, your village or at least your district.
And that, that's one of the fun things. You know, when I lived in Palo Alto at Stanford, you know, it was fun to see the local weather reports, unlike in many other parts of the world where it, the whole country... is, you know, you get a very generalized picture, whereas in California, it was at the county level. It's like, you know, when is the mist in San Francisco going to be burnt up? You know, something like that. So how do you see development moving on? This has been a pretty interesting year, 2025. I don't know what's going to happen in New York at the General Assembly. World leaders are getting together. I don't know if it is about optimism, pessimism, maybe a bit of both. We should be talking, in my view, much more about how some of these countries that are still invested in global development, that are still interested in showing global solidarity, can find new ways of collaborating with each other, maybe with new actors, not just saying China, oh, we can't trust them. Maybe we should be partnering with new actors, Japan or the UAE or whoever, maybe devising new ways, thinking about how one could support South-South cooperation, maybe North-South. What are your thoughts here on going forward?
So I think it's very much going to be a world of different coalitions working on different issues together. It's not, you know, we're very much moving away from the US as a leader in many areas. Maybe that's temporary, but probably not. You know, hopefully things, you know, the US re-engages in the world more constructively again, but the world is changing. There are going to be a range of actors. Different actors have different priorities. I think we're going to have to build these coalitions in different ways. I wanted to pick up on your point about South-South cooperation. Obviously, I'm not from the South, but I am involved in a very, for me, optimistic South-South cooperation approach, which is taking this innovation in how you teach that was developed in India and bringing it to the continent of Africa. And we help seed and build up, and now we, as Northerners, are withdrawing from this organization Teaching at the Right Level Africa, which works very closely in partnership with the Indian NGO that developed the program. So you see very directly the South-South cooperation. And I think of, you know, BRAC working in Africa and bringing a whole approach to NGOs that is unique to South Asia.
And so what worked in some of these countries could be replicated elsewhere, but not by northern institutions, but by
Northern organizations, you know, potentially supported by. I mean, northern organizations have supported some of this, but the actual expertise has been flowing from south to south. And you now see innovations in the African organization being fed back to the Indian organization. And it's just so inspiring to see. And it's not that the Indian organization is set up in Africa. It's helped seed an African organization, which is then adapting and doing things differently. And it became very clear that there were things that were going to have to change, not just in Africa. Obviously, Africa is a huge continent with very different contexts. So, you know, the work in Zambia is different from the work in Cote d'Ivoire, is different from the work in Kenya. You know, Kenya has a much higher level of education. So it's very different, but it draws a huge amount of inspiration and support from the South-South cooperation. And it's very inspiring. And I hope is the future.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that, on that optimistic note. Rachel, thank you very much for coming to my home today and for this really fun conversation.
Great to be here and great to chat as ever.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Bannick from the University of Oslo. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.